My name is David Livingston. I'm an independent researcher, writer. I've been at it now for 30 years. My main focus has been the influence, I guess you could say, of the occult. But what I'm really trying to do is to understand what's happening in our world today. And to do that, those who are leading most of the political activities that shape our time are guided by beliefs and associations that are typically held away from the public. And so what I found is that the only way to understand where these ideas are coming from is to trace them back to the occult. And to understand the occult has been a lot of effort to take it back right to its very origins, which I trace back to about the 6th century BC, which is why I've written 5 books. My latest is a 6-volume set called Ordo Ab Chao, which means Latin for order out of chaos, which is the slogan of Scottish Rite Freemasonry, which explains cryptically what they're really trying to do, which is, of course, we're to understand it that they're trying to bring order out of chaos, but what they're doing is they are sowing chaos as a transition towards the type of order that they intend to create.
Now, you're talking about this, you know, this whole idea there of the true agenda being hidden from the public. So we're getting a kind of layers and layers of the onion with we're getting the outside layers. There's things going on in the middle there that we are not privy to. Yeah. What you're sort of implying there is that the political leadership is actually there as a kind of PR thing. And actually there's I hesitate to use the word, but I don't know if you would, but a kind of priesthood behind the scenes.
Yeah. So I think this is the way I've been describing it recently, is that when you look at what is happening now in Israel, to make clear that, you know, people have been very absorbed in all kinds of debates and topics that they believe are at the forefront of, you know, like Western intellectual progress. So democracy and then, you know, the struggle with liberalism against the right, and secularism, even, let's say, postmodern philosophy, issues of feminism, issues of racism, so on and so forth. So all the isms and schisms, as we used to say, when in reality, those are all distractions, because the real actors in the world today, if you look at the actual history of at least the last half century, certainly the last century, has been shaped by effectively a Zionist plan. And so what we're seeing is that the people who were the core protagonists of the Bible continue to be today the leading protagonists of history today. So it's not the Buddhists. It's not really the Muslims. It's not the Taoists. It's not Zoroastrians. It's not pagans. It's not atheists. The history of the world basically continues to be an ongoing continuation of that history, which was already outlined in the Bible.
So is that yes? You think it's a kind of, we talk about things like the deep state are running things, you know, but Bill Cooper, I think actually it was in the 1990s, Bill Cooper in the States was talking about this whole idea of there being a kind of mystery religion priesthood secretly behind the scenes, what he described as the adepts who were adept at controlling everyone else.
Yeah. So, I mean, it depends on how you want to look at them. So basically we're looking at a group of people who have interpreted, because it comes back to the history of Kabbalah. That's what it really is. So, and Kabbalah is basically a distorted version of Bible prophecy. So twisting Bible prophecy to their advantage so that the God's promise is to the chosen people is ever binding. It's never to be revoked, regardless of their actions. And then really fundamentally, if I could say so, it's Luciferian. So it incorporates the idea that the ends justify the means. So any means, because effectively these chosen people are chosen above the rest of humanity, chosen to rule humanity, and so they are entitled to use any means at their disposal to advance their domination. So in short, that's basically what we're looking at. And there's, you know, this history goes back, as I mentioned before, it goes back to Babylon in 6th century BC. It has survived and been modified over the centuries so that it's come under many different guises. The first would be Greek philosophy. Then we're looking at the various cults of the Roman times, so cults like the cults of Mithras, cults of Isis, the philosophy of Neoplatonism, Hermeticism, and these all formed the foundation of what's called the Western esoteric tradition. That was inherited in Islamic world, where it became Sufism, the cult of the Ismailis, which supposedly was transmitted to the Crusaders, principally the Templars. And there you get the legend of Freemasonry. Well, first of all, Rosicrucianism and then Freemasonry. So when we're talking about a modern priesthood, we're talking about adepts, I guess you could say, who belong usually to secret societies that adhere to some kind of mix of some kind of variation of that legend. So to what role exactly they play? What, to what role are they a recruiting ground? Or what role, to what extent are they a means to incorporate dupes into the plot? Or if they are the actual architects of the plot? That's the part I find that's really very difficult to understand. You know, especially when you look at 20th century occultism, if you look at people like Blavatsky, Crowley, René Guénon, Julius Savola, and of course, you know, let's say today, people like Dugin. To what who are the architects and who are the dupes? I find that's the part that's
It's difficult to work out. I think it's always been a bit like that. When you're finding a political party is being infiltrated, you're never quite sure whether it's actually infiltration or it's just somebody's ego getting the better of them that's destroying the party from within. So who knows? But I mean, you know, if you're talking about Luciferianism, I think we need to be clear about how that differs from Satanism and how it relates to, I mean, I imagine this is what you mean when you're talking about the occult.
Well, I mean, the historically, the occultists have had a history of trying to differentiate between Lucifer and Satan, right? So you find that back going to Albert Pike and his Morals and Dogma. And because that's sort of how they rationalize their worship of Satan, claiming that they're not worshiping the evil Satan, they're worshiping, you know, some fallen angel of light or something like that. But that's just a con game. It is Lucifer and it is evil that they choose, you know, regardless of whatever name you call it. The thing is, you know, the devil didn't invent evil. Evil was a propensity that existed before humans or the devil himself. So, but the devil is trying to recruit as much of humanity to evil as he can. So, that's fundamentally what the difference comes down to, or the lack of difference.
Satanists themselves talk about It's not really a religion, they say. It's like, you know, we don't really believe in a God. Yeah. We do follow ideas, satanic ideas, but really it's about the elevation of the self, the elevation of the ego.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, Satanism is like, I mean, it's like any other, I guess you could call it a religious or ideological tradition. It's got various sects and interpretations. And you'll find many that are sort of pop Satanists that, you know, have difficulty with sort of the religious associations of Satanism. So they try to sort of secularize it. And, yeah, they provide these kinds of interpretations to excuse their actions and free it from biblical connotations. But it's usually those kinds of Satanists are not really the true Satanists at the core who are at the helm, let's say.
Again, it's another onion we're looking at here. What about Nazism? Because I can remember Winston Churchill, who Dennis Wheatley thought was a member of the Illuminati, saying that this was a battle for Christian civilization going on. And I think many people in the 1939 and 1940, the early part of World War II, really did feel that there was some kind of satanic force. So, you know, were there links, genuine links between that we can make between the Nazis and some kind of satanic idea or, you know, that level of evil?
Well, it's funny because I was just reviewing that whole topic today because, there's a book which is probably the most well-recognized book on Nazism and the occult by, Nicholas Goodrich Clark. And, it's really a whitewash. He seems to be embarrassed by any suggestion that there's an association between Nazism and the occult. Because his sort of point is that there's no sort of definitive proof that Hitler espoused any occult doctrines himself or that he was a member of the Thule Society. So that most of the claims are fanciful, which is completely ridiculous because we're talking about a movement that adopted an occult symbol, the swastika, as its flag. And, most of its outlook was derived, it's pretty clear it derived from the occult. And then, of course, most of the leading personalities of the Nazi party, particularly people like Himmler, were undoubtedly devoted to the occult. I mean, the SS was an occult organization. But what's really interesting, and this is crazy, is that even if you read Goodrich Clark's book, he shows that Rudolf von Sebettendorf, who was the founder of the Thule Society, traveled to Turkey, where he learned Kabbalah from a Turkish Jewish family from Salonika. And so he doesn't dispute the point. he openly acknowledges it. But of course, then he would suggest that, you know, the Thule Society had a limited influence on the Nazi party. The reality is that the Thule Society was responsible for the founding of the German Workers' Party that eventually changed its name to the Nazi party. So they were through and through at the core, the source of the Nazi movement and its ideology, which again goes back to the Kabbalah. But what's important is that the Salonika in Greece was also the base of the Sabbatian movement. And so in particular, Sebettendorf got introduced to the Sufism of the Bektashi. And the Bektashi were what happened to the Sabbatian movement is that after Shabtai Zvi converted to Islam, his followers followed him in his conversion and became a sect known as the Donmei, who exists to this day. It's a very peculiar community because they practice Islam in public, but practice Kabbalistic Judaism in secret. And so they were also responsible for the formation of the Young Turk movement, who were in turn responsible for the overthrow of the Islamic Empire in Turkey. And so this was the network that Subodh was affiliated with. What's also interesting is the close connection between, because the Young Turks was named after the young movements that were founded by Giuseppe Mazzini, who by several accounts was the successor of the head of the Illuminati. And he created a number of movements like Young Italy, Young Germany, Young Poland, and so on. And so the Young Turks was a variation of it. And associated with them was Zev Jabotinsky. Zev Jabotinsky, of course, whose secretary was Netanyahu's father.
Oh. Well, look, you know, before we leave the subject of the Nazis, I think it's, you know, it's really important to understand what we should be learning today from all that.
Yeah.
Dennis Wheatley talked about Hitler as a man god. And he even said, look, this is almost like a prototype for the Antichrist. The idea is, you know, that you create the SS. The SS were based in Wevelsburg Castle. You know, as you mentioned himself, Himmler, in charge of these rituals and ceremonies in the basement of the castle, where this order of knighthood, effectively, that's what it was, all dedicated themselves to the order, but maybe just on the surface to Adolf Hitler as well. And, you know, so you've got this idea of a man god. Now, I don't think many people really look back. They realized the Nazis' actions were evil and what they were doing, just rolling over countries. For example, you know, these massive concentration camps where they were putting all the so-called Untermensch. But this man god is most definitely some kind of believes in this master race. So what do you make of this man god idea, and whether or not we might see it emerge again?
Right. Well, that's a good question. I think that's what we have to guard against, because I think that's exactly the kernel of the point, right? It's what's unique. What was unique about the Nazi movement was, as you say, wasn't their military actions, but the cult of personality that they built around Hitler. And so that was the result of the efforts of the Thule Society, because the Thule Society had created the Münchener Beobachter, the Munich Observer. And that was founded by or bought by Subodendorf. And then after the creation of the Nazi Party, it was appropriated by the Nazi Party and then changed the name to the Völkischer Beobachter or the Völkisch Observer. And it was operated by the Eyre Publishing House, which is basically a Nazi or Thule publishing house. And so through that publishing house, the Nazis managed to eventually monopolize the German press. And so they used the press to push forward what they call the Führerprinzip, which is the Führer principle. So basically what happened is that there's a very strange story that in World War One, 1919, Hitler was hospitalized for a case of what they diagnosed as hysterical blindness. So he was temporarily blind. It was a sort of like a psychosomatic kind of blindness. And it was during his hospitalization. In fact, he had heard the voice already, but he started having contact with this, what he called the voice. And then, so the entire basis of his career was him completely giving himself in to the commands that he was receiving from this voice. There's a whole story. This is a part that I write about in Ordo Ab Tau, about the time in Pasewalk, because, there was a fictional book that talked about an AH who had undergone some kind of hypnosis by the doctors in Pasewalk. And so some kind of strange circumstances there happened, for either Hitler was hypnotized or he was like demonically possessed or something like that. But what's interesting is that he's released from the army, and then he goes to work for the Reichswehr. which had deep links with the Thule Society, and he's hired to go infiltrate the German Workers' Party to observe or whatever it was the his task was. And within a couple of months, he starts speaking, and it's when he's speaking that the members of the Thule Society were so impressed by his supposed rhetorical skills that they believed him to be the Messiah that they were expecting. Now, if you remember that Hitler was a failed art student, he was rejected twice from art school. He lived in a sort of a dormitory for impoverished people in Vienna. I don't think he graduated high school. And then he comes out of first few months out of World War One, and then basically gets selected as the leader of this new far right, basically fascist political party. So this whole idea of Hitler as being some kind of a channeler, because I'm sure that's the way they would have understood him to be. I don't think, you know, if you look at most of the comments of the people who observed him, they believe that he was possessed. And maybe they wouldn't have used those words somehow, but they believe that he was a vehicle for some kind of force message, you know.
Higher powers.
Yeah. Yes, Jung who believed that he was, you know, channeling the archetype of Wotan or Odin. And so so basically that whole concept of Hitler being a vehicle for this effectively diabolical force, they view this diabolical force as being positive, a chaotic force, and then they transmitted that to the rest of the German population. And they built up this whole idea of the Führer Prinzip, this idea that the Führer is the guide, effectively the savior of the German people, and he had to be obeyed unconditionally. And this is why you had this whole cult personality inside the Nazi Party, where Hitler's word was God's word, and you should never dare to question it, because he was the vehicle for some kind of higher power and guided by some kind of higher force. So effectively, that's the nature. That's effectively the nature. That's how, I mean, the thing is, you know, the Nazis hijacked their leadership, right? They barely squeezed the majority in, I think it was 1933, 1934, and it was only with the Enabling Act and the Reichstag fire that they managed to implement. Yeah, sorry, the Enabling Act, which gave him dictatorial powers. And so he effectively seized power against the will of the German people and then ran with it. So, you know, I don't know how much resistance there was after that or how much compliance there was. Definitely, you know, with the control of the press, they managed to build quite a bit of acquiescence. But, yeah, it was basically by hijacking the power. I think that's where we need to be careful, because, you know, when we talk about people like Tucker Carlson, these guys are snakes that are using, people's false hope and optimism to see change, by pretending to identify what appear to be the culprits of the problems in our time. And so the Nazis did the very same thing, right? So the Nazis operated by, principally they used the Protocols of Zion to point to the Russian Revolution as having been a Masonic Jewish plot. And they basically put forward the idea that there was this, you know, Masonic Jewish cabal that was out to gain world domination, and when really they were its tool. But that's how they managed to fool many Germans who were suspecting that some kind of conspiracy was afoot, that they were actually going to be its solution. So this is the most important premise of my book Ordo Ab Cal, is to show that this has been the modus operandi of the far right for the entire century. The entire century has been to cultivate a perception of the existence of a conspiracy to then prefer themselves as the solution. They did this throughout the Cold War in the United States through organizations like the John Birch Society in particular, who were the sort of the chief purveyors of conspiracy literature. And then you see that more recently with people like Alex Jones, who is, you know, covered with all kinds of intelligence connections. And QAnon is another example. And now you see him being carried forward. This, basically, guys like Tucker Carlson are just clones of the same kind of stooges that were used back in the Cold War. And how their plotting works is to recognize where people's fundamental complaints are and then to identify with them and to present themselves as, possible tools for their resolution.
Yeah, but I mean, as you said last time we spoke, we mustn't judge people. And one of the things that bothers me is that we're now seeing, it seems to me, deliberate discrediting of democracy right across Europe and the United States. And mm-hmm. the idea really is to infiltrate the political parties, to steer the political agenda, to just simply, I mean, for example, here in Bristol, we've got four MPs, all Labour. We've got an extremely pro-Palestine city. Something like 80% of the population, extremely pro-Palestine. We've had some of the biggest ever demonstrations in the city. Peaceful, thank goodness, so far. And yet none of those MPs would vote for a ceasefire. We have another vote this week. And so obviously there is an enormous amount of disillusionment with our politicians. In fact, people going up to them in the street when they're out canvassing in the local elections and screaming and shouting at them, or even just persistently asking them, why do you abstain on genocide? You know, what's this all about? And so this, of course, does leave a kind of red carpet for a kind of fascist system to come in. Once you've got democracy being, this is what bothers me. But look, before we get the game, before we get off the Nazis, my favorite theme, what about their links to theosophy? Because I understand theosophy is something which kind of cropped up as a, almost to fill the gap left by Darwin. And the other aspect to a call, of course, is pantheism, something people often forget. And we're seeing now, we've got farmer protests going on in Britain, much bigger ones going on in continental Europe. But here it's going to, I think, get enormous in the next few, certainly after the general election when you get a Labour government here. Because they're telling the livestock farmers, no, you can't. No, you can't rear livestock. It's not ethical. It's very bad for the environment, blah, blah. And private equity firms are coming up to buy their land. And so there's definitely this element of, eulogizing animals, almost kind of anthropomorphism going on. So that's the pantheistic side I'm trying to bring in here. If you could say something about that.
To go back to the point of theosophy, what it goes back to, basically, theosophy came out of the occult revival and presented itself as a reaction to the which is true, the excessive empiricism of the Enlightenment. But then instead they proposed that, Western society had gone too far. They had dismissed the supernatural as superstition. So instead, basically the Enlightenment had rejected God and, demons and angels. And so what the, occult revival did was say it's gone too far, but instead of resurrecting God, they only resurrected the demons. So, well, that's why it's a period where seances became popular. So the idea where people, started to think kind of like a little bit what's happening now with the New Age movement, thinking that, maybe there is more maybe there is something beyond the material. Maybe there are spirits. Maybe there's, which is true, right? There's something. The Enlightenment went too far, but the problem is they use it as a trapdoor to catch people into spiritualism. And so the leading personality of the occult revival was a guy named Edward Bulwer Lytton. And he was a member of what's called the Frankfurt Judenlodge. So for, there's a whole book written on the, mostly on the Loon Lodge by Joseph Katz, I think, who's written a classic called Jews and Freemasonry. And he shows that for the most part, Jews were barred from entering Masonic lodges, except so they effectively created this one lodge called this Union Lodge in Frankfurt. It's called, I think, the Rising Lodge of the Rising Dawn in Frankfurt. And it was founded by a Rothschild agent and members of the Asiatic Brethren. So the Asiatic Brethren was a Sabbatian secret society founded by Moses Dobrushka, who was the nephew of Jacob Frank, who claimed to be a successor of Shabtai Zvi. And so this network of Sabbatians were all part of a circle of friends closely connected to Moses Mendelssohn. So Moses Mendelssohn was crucial because he's considered the founder of what's called the Haskalah, or the Jewish Enlightenment. And so to put this in context, we have to remember that until him, Jews lived for the most part in segregated ghettos in various parts of Europe. They were severely restricted, but not always, that's not something, not necessarily something they were opposed to, because often they wanted to keep apart because they wanted to preserve their traditions. So what Moses Mendelssohn proposed, because he was a, according to Rabbi Antelman, he was a crypto Sabbatian. In fact, he was a successor, an anointed successor of Shabtai Zvi. So he called what another book by Jacob Katz called Out of the Ghetto, which called on Jews basically to leave the ghetto and to assimilate into German culture. Now, he was also friends with people, several members of Illuminati, particularly Lessing and Friedrich Nicolai, who was a famous Illuminati publisher, and Gottfried, the philosopher Gottfried Herder. But he was also admired by the entire circle of philosophers associated with what's called Weimar, I'll pronounce it the German version, Weimar classicism, which basically gave birth to the German Romantic movement. So that includes not only Herder, but Goethe and Fichte and the Schlegel brothers and anyway, that whole circle of German Romantics. So that's the same circle that produced German nationalism. There's two important components that came out of that. So first, this is at the time when the theory of the Aryan race was being developed. And the man who coined the term Aryan was Friedrich Schlegel, who was married to Dorothea, Moses Mendelssohn's daughter. The under component, because we talked about the Völkische Beobachter, which is the Völkisch observer, it's named after the Völkisch tradition, which is part of this Aryosophic, Theosophical Nazi tradition, dates back to Herder, who was again Moses Mendelssohn's friend. So you're looking at this, basically this network of German philosophers connected to Moses Mendelssohn, leader of this Haskalah associated with the Asiatic Brethren, was the give birth to effectively the German nationalism that evolved into the Nazi movement. So the Asiatic Brethren, they were led by Prince Charles of Hessen-Kassel. So this is a family which is crucially important because he was a direct descendant of Maurice of Hessen-Kassel, who was the original sponsor of the Rosicrucian movement. His brother, Wilhelm of Hesse, was with his brother, Wilhelm of Hesse, that Amschel Rothschild founded the Rothschild dynasty. And Prince Charles of Hessen-Kassel was also a member of the Illuminati, but he was also a Grand Master of the Asiatic Brethren and a sponsor of the Frankfurt Juden Lodge. There's a few other strange connections I would love to mention. Basically, So what's very, very strange is that when Theodor Herzl wrote the Judenstadt, which is the Jewish state, which is the book which is considered foundational to the Zionist movement, he starts off by explaining that every night he could in Vienna, he would attend Wagner's performance of Tannhäuser, Tannhäuser, the opera. So what's very strange, and he said that basically it was only on the nights that he wasn't able to attend the opera that he ever lost doubt in the cause of Zionism. It makes no sense to me, because when you look at the opera Tannhäuser, what it's based on is what's called the Sängerkrieg. This is a songwriting contest that took place in the 1300s at the residence of Hermann Landgrave of Thuringia. And it was the song contest at which Wolfram von Eschenbach wrote the Percival story. And why it's important is because it's the story of the Knight of the Swan. And so because all of these aristocratic families can all trace their descent to the Knight of the Swan, particularly the families that were associated with the foundation of the Rosicrucian movement. And they were also the movement that supported the mission of Martin Luther. And so this is how Martin Luther was the first to appropriate the symbol of the rose, which is a Kabbalistic symbol, which was then adopted by the Rosicrucians. And Luther himself admitted that his mission was a Kabbalistic one. And he also, basically where he wrote his translation of the New Testament was at Wartburg Castle. And Wartburg Castle, it was the site at which this Tannhäuser or Sängerkrieg, as Wagner wrote about, took place. So now what's important is that the sponsor of Weimar classicism was Carl August of Sachs-Weimar-Eisenach, which was located, his seat was located in Eisenach, which is where the Wartburg Castle is located. And he claimed descent from the Night Swan. So he was also a member of the Illuminati, and there was a lodge, a Masonic lodge named after his mother, which was the chief Illuminati lodge after the disbanding of the Illuminati, meaning that the Illuminati survived in Weimar. So now it is where you're looking at basically as Weimar was this confluence of the survival of the Illuminati, the preservation of this whole idea of the mythological importance of the Night Swan, and the birth of German nationalism. It was one of the people, one of the men who was most important, probably the most important influence in the rise of German nationalism was Wagner. And Wagner, of course, wrote not only Tannhäuser, but also the Percival opera. Because yeah, according to Wagner's son-in-law, who was, what's his name? Houston Chamberlain? Was it Richard Houston Chamberlain? Stuart Houston Chamberlain. His son-in-law claimed that Wagner was the legitimate son of Carl August's brother. So what you see now is very strange, is that you have this simultaneously you have the Zionist tradition through Herzl and the Nazi tradition, both claiming descent in their veneration of the Percival and Tannhäuser legends developed by Wagner, that was core to the families, the Illuminati families that sponsored the Weimar classicism that it grew out of in the first place.
Yeah, so that's a pretty good look into German occultism. It always seems to be sort of, well, I mean, we could probably be here all night talking about it, David, but yeah, I don't even got to mention Nietzsche,
right.
Who really, he brought about that, you know, this whole philosophy of the man god, the Superman, is his thing, really. You know, this idea of, look, just kick God in the teeth is effectively what he's saying, and find yourself the right man and worship him. And then all of a sudden you get Adolf Hitler popping up. And funnily enough, Hitler's favorite philosopher or writer is Nietzsche, who's kind of setting him up to be this kind of person. Right. But anyway, maybe, I don't know how much, you know about this Brotherhood of Saturn, which is also supposed to be German occultism, which gave rise to some kind of duplicate of itself, maybe in other, but certainly in the United States. And we've seen also the Skull and Bones there. So before we get off the topic, I mean, we know that the, you know, there were big links between the United States and the Nazis, particularly through Operation Paperclip. That came out, you know, pretty much straight after World War II. Gosh, all these Nazis are just running over to the United States, being recruited into this new organization called the CIA. And so maybe you could say something about, you know, maybe that going back much further than World War II, Yale University, and something like maybe the Brotherhood of Saturn, I don't know, in Germany.
Yeah. Well, there's what's called the Brotherhood of Death, if that's what you mean, is the one which is what the Skull and Bones shares with the Nazis. But I mean, that's the thing, right? It's all one tradition. So, that's why if we go back to Edward Buller-Lytton, as a member of the Frankfurt Judenlodge, he wrote a book called Coming Race, which again referred to the power of the Vril, which inspired the Vril Society, which was linked to the Thule Society. But basically, so out of this occult revival that he inspired, this is where you get H.P. Blavatsky. And she is the one who sort of reformulated the growing idea of an Aryan race, but added a whole lot of occult mythology to it. That occult mythology was adopted by two personalities, Guido von Liszt and Lance von Liebenfels. Guido von Liszt founded the Liszt Society, and it was members of the Liszt Society that basically, it was the influence of Guido von Liszt and Liebenfels that led to the founding of the Thule Society. So the Nazis to theosophy, they are the link of the Nazis to theosophy, but also to the OTO, because Franz Hartmann, who I believe was a member of the Liszt Society, am I getting that right? He was also a Theosophist and a member of the OTO, Ordo Templi Orientis. So, you know, this kind of brings us back to the point too of like, who's really running this thing, right? Like it's, because what's really strange is when you look at the history of most occultists, they all work for intelligence agencies going all the way back to John Dee. So, you know, I don't know who's in charge. You know, most of these guys, they seem so fringy that you can't imagine that they are governing anything in particular. I don't know if they serve as sort of priests instead. So, I mean, that would kind of explain Synarchy. But really, it comes back to Synarchy, and the link between them all is exactly Synarchism. And that basically is sort of what linked the Nazis with most of the other fascist movements, either in Italy or in France and elsewhere, particularly during the Vichy regime in France. So, and another important point is that, you know, it's risky to say, but there were a lot of, in fact, this is explored by a book by Mark Rigg, which has been very well received, called Hitler's Nazis. But a lot of leading Nazis were Jewish. One in particular is Reinhard Heydrich. You know, what's strange is that's why there's a book called The Torquemada Principle, which is a novel that was written, I believe, in the 70s. And it's supposed to be a fictional book that Reinhard Heydrich receives a file, but they call it the Torquemada file, which supposedly has proof that Hitler was Jewish. And the reason why they call it the Torquemada file is because it's named after the Inquisitor during the reign of Ferdinand and Isabella, who led the Spanish Inquisition that persecuted so many Jews, when in fact he was a secret Jew himself. So not to explain why the cause of what motivated to cause so much misery against fellow Jews, but it's sort of suggestive of a similarity with Hitler and other Nazis in the party. Because what's really strange is that there's two people who were the leading Nazis employed by the CIA after World War II. One of them was Reinhard Gehlen, whose Gehlen org turned into the German BND. And the other one was Otto Skorzeny, who was really the personality at the head of the recruitment of fascist terrorists worldwide in the employ of the CIA, really one of the leading personalities of the Fascist International. But he also simultaneously worked for Mossad.
Cool. Well, look, before we get off the topic completely, you touched there on the OTO. And I'd like to take a step back from all this for a minute, if you don't mind. I mean, we mentioned this whole idea of the swastika coming from Hinduism. Actually, here, where I went to college, up in Yorkshire, in Ilkley, it's in Yorkshire. And up on the hill there, we had something, we would walk, you know, on a really lovely summer's day, you walk along, took about 2 hours walking along the tops on the moors next to the college and the town. And there was something called the swastika stone,
right,
where there's a Neolithic monument which has got a massive swastika carved into it. You know, I think it's the Nazi way round. In other words, a right-handed swastika.
Yeah.
And so I think we have to understand that the monotheistic faiths, including, by the way, the Zoroastrians, the Rastafarians, all of them, have this concept of good versus evil. Mm-hmm. But the Eastern faiths, they don't quite so much do that. They have this kind of pantheon of gods, and some of the gods are rough and ready, others are very kind, and people kind of choose their own gods. There are rulers of the gods, and this is the Eastern way, and the monotheism has become the Western way. And so this is what Crowley is writing about. In fact, he's hinting at when one of his mates, called Sax Roma, writes the phrase, out of the fire, I shall rise, he says, thinking really here of the golden dawn, I shall rise. The red dusk of the west will have fallen. The golden dawn of the east will come. So in a way, Roma is kind of speaking, breaking his oaths of silence when he's writing about this in a novel form.
Yeah.
But this seems to me to be this, you know, if you just set atheism aside, two completely different ways of looking at the world in the spiritual world, one of which is this Eastern way, and the other is this Western way of good versus evil. Now, you know, you can argue for a long time about, you know, I'm evil, you're good, you know, whatever. So obviously the Israelis right now are arguing that they're the good guys and that they're just trying to kill off all the bad guys by bombing Gaza. But there's no pretense that there's a lot of infusing of this with things like, you know, we're getting rid of the Amalekites and, you know, from the Old Testament, Netanyahu quoting the Old Testament, this sort of thing.
Yeah.
So what do you make of this sort of battle that seems to be going on that Crowley is hinting at all the way through? He's saying actually what's going to happen is the monotheistic faiths and this whole idea of good and evil is going to be crushed. And there's just going to be this kind of reverting to the a pantheon of gods. And, you know, the future generations are just going to choose their gods. And it's up to them if they want to be good or evil. It's a libertarian world we're going into.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, it's important, you know, the Eastern religions are as mixed and varied as the Western religions. So there's Orthodox traditions and there's heterodox traditions, right? So what a lot of people don't realize is, for example, Tibetan Buddhism is very much a heretical branch of Buddhism, and probably not an accident why Western occultists picked it, particularly because of the influence of Tantra, which came from India, and what's called left-hand Tantra. So this is where you get this whole concept of what came to be known as the, or Martha Key Shushart described it as, the Oriental Kabbalah. So in the time of Swedenborg in particular, Western occultists had begun to, basically Europe, in England in particular, with its conquest of India, had just started to discover Indian culture and Buddhism and Hinduism, and they discovered Tantra. So when they discovered it, particularly somebody like Swedenborg, who was practicing Sabbatian Kabbalistic sex rites, he thought what was an immediate similarity. So they concluded that there was such a thing as an Oriental Kabbalah, which preceded the Jewish Kabbalah. And this is how the whole idea of the Aryan race was developed, because the Aryan race were invented to provide a pedigree for this Jewish Kabbalah. So basically, the Aryans supposedly learned magic and mysticism from the fallen angels on Atlantis. And when Atlantis was destroyed, they escaped and landed in the mountains of Asia, either the Caucasus or whichever, and then they spread out from there. And they spread to India, they spread to Persia, and they spread to Europe, where they brought their language, which is now known as Indo-European, and they brought their culture. And so to Tibet, supposedly, they brought what was called Bon Shamanism, and then Bon Shamanism influenced Tibetan Buddhism. And so that's basically, this is the whole idea that Blavatsky adopted. And so this is why the original home of the Aryans was supposed to be this legendary place called Shambhala, which is interchangeable with Agartha, which is the land revered by the Synarchists. So, you know, what's supposed to happen is that this primordial tradition, as they call it, is supposed to upend and supplant the monotheistic tradition, because again, this is a Gnostic belief system, so they believe in the same Bible as you do, except they reread it in reverse. What's interesting is that this is mentioned in Dan Brown's book called The Lost Symbol. And the whole point is, after his, you know, all his books have all these ridiculous chases in it, the end of the chase is that finally they discover that the lost symbol of Freemasonry is the Bible. But he answers by quoting William Blake that it's not the Bible that every person reads, something along the lines of where you read black, I read white. So the idea is basically that they read the Bible in reverse, whereas the coming of the end times, the Antichrist is the hero who is going to war against the Messiah. And I mean, there's no prediction of the overthrow of the Messiah or the victory of Satan, so I don't know how they read it, but they have taken Satan's side, and they believe, that's the side that they've taken. So basically, when what somebody like Aleister Crowley is trying to do is, we have to remember that these are Satanists, so they have relinquished any kind of hold to conventional morality, and they embrace immorality or amorality. So no crime is too awful. So that killing is innocent people, harming children, babies, elderly, any level of deception, everything goes. So, in fact, the worse it is, the more of an act of worship it is. So they will go at any length to try to advance their cause, and that cause is to overthrow God and to bring about this end time confrontation or Armageddon to eventually get all of humanity to reject God and to accept you know, what's always been called what Cynicus called the primordial tradition. That's what René Guénon referred to it. It used to be called in the Renaissance the ancient wisdom. But really what it comes down to, it's the Kabbalistic religion based on the worship of Lucifer and the practice of magic. That's what the goal is, right? It's a Gnostic war. It's not a war of believers against disbelievers. It's a war of believers against Gnostics. Two camps that both adhere to the same prophecy, but who choose a different side in the prophecy.
There are a lot of people who have been criticizing Arab countries over the last few months since the Gaza genocide began, mm-hmm. David, and saying things, very rude things actually, about the Syrians, the Iranians, the Lebanese, the Jordanians even. And I mean, you can see why, because they can see a lot of people in Gaza suffering. They want Arab countries to come intervene to give Israel a bloody nose. Yeah. In order to stop the killing, which is completely understandable. And yet many of those Arab leaders see this as a trap. The idea is that as soon as they escalate the war, the Israelis and the United States will escalate it even further. You could end up with Armageddon.
Yeah.
So anyway, one of the reasons I contacted you this week is because Hamas is at the center of a lot of this. And the idea is that the Israelis want to eliminate Hamas. Hamas is actually was elected by the Palestinian people in Gaza, and so it's legitimate that they, you know, it's a bit like Hezbollah in Lebanon. It's totally legitimate. It represents a majority of the population, and so what they're doing is that by saying we want to eliminate Hamas, what they're really saying is we want to eliminate Gaza, and so there's also the revelations at the very beginning of all this, which seem to have been forgotten now, that actually the Likud party and Netanyahu in his little huddle before, I think it was 2 years before this started, was revealed and reported in the Israeli press to have been funding Hamas. The idea being saying that, you know, if we can fund this organization, we can steer the peace process basically down a rabbit hole and make sure it never really happens. So what do you make of Hamas, its origins and its effectiveness for the Palestinian people or as a tool of the Mossad?
So what's interesting is that, you know, you can trace it all back to the same source of Moses Mendelssohn, right? So you're looking at three traditions that came out of, let's say, the Asiatic Brethren, the Frankfurt Newton Lodge. And they are theosophy, which evolved into Aristotelian Hitlerism, and Zionism, and Salafism, which is the affliction in the Islamic world. You have one person in particular. His name is Jamaluddin al-Afghani. And Blavatsky, she acquired her teachings from these disembodied spirits that went by various names, the several ascended masters, she called them. And one of them was Jamal Afghani, who was supposedly one of the masters of the Brotherhood of Luxor. And so this again, it's the same tradition that goes back to the Asiatic Brethren. And by another name, by another personality that he took on, going by the name of Haji Sharif, he introduced Saint-Yves d'Alvedre to the secret of Agartha, which gave birth to the Cynarchist tradition. By yet another personality, by his name of the supposed Islamic reformer, also Grand Master of the Freemasons of Egypt, he founded what's called the Salafi Reform Movement of Islam. So what's important is that Islam had a unified legal tradition that was followed practically unanimously throughout the Sunni Muslim world for about 1,000 years. And so the purpose of his mission was to undermine it, because he was working in league with the British, particularly people like Lord Cromer in Egypt, other people like Scallon Blunt, who again was linked to this entire network, the Esophageal Network, and E.G. Brown. Anyway, so what they needed to do was to, he proposed that Islam was failing to, was falling behind the West, because it was holding on to a stagnant legal tradition. And the only way to revive Islam was to free it from the stranglehold that had been placed on it by this tradition, and to reform it. So that's effectively the basis of this Salafi movement. Where they first achieved support was in Saudi Arabia. His student, his name was Rashid Rida, was the first one to create an alliance between the Wahhabi movement. Wahhabi movement was, again, there's an excellent article online, was originally written in Arabic, was translated. In fact, there was I posted it on my website back in 2004, I think, that the Americans had discovered a document produced by Iraqi intelligence that claimed that the Saudi royal family were descended from Dunmay Sabbateans, and that Abdul Wahhab, the founder of the Wahhabi movement, was again also a Dunmay Sabbatean, out effectively to undermine Islam. So the Wahhabis and the Salafis had pretty much the same mission, which was exactly that, which was to throw away centuries of Islamic legal tradition and to quote-unquote reform it and free it to sort of reinterpret Islam for modern times, which is effectively what they've done. So with Saudi funding, which came from the Rockefellers, because it's all through collaboration with the Rock, with SoCal Rockefeller Oil Company, for the exploitation of oil in Saudi Arabia, which became the third largest source of petroleum worldwide, that they achieved enormous wealth. They carried out what is considered to be the largest propaganda campaign in history, which was for the spread of this philosophy, Salafi cult. They have effectively, the estimates claim that they control up to 80% of the mosques outside the Islamic world, so in the West, like places like Britain, United States, and Canada, where they've been managed to spread this Salafi message, which goes back to this Satanist Jamal ad-Din Afghani. So out of the Salafi movement came established, I can't remember what year it was, I think it was 1928, with British support, was the foundation of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is effectively a crypto-Masonic organization. The founder was Hassan al-Banna, and he was recruited to put the Muslim Brotherhood at the service of Nazi intelligence. And this is why you find a very close relationship between the Nazi Brotherhood going on for many years, both before World War One, or leading to World War II, sorry, and after World War II, including with people like Skorzeny and Reinhard Gehlen and that network. They were discovered, and you know about Miles Copeland. Miles Copeland is the one who revealed that the Muslim Brotherhood was through and through at the disposal of pretty much any intelligence organization worldwide. And especially after World War II and the fall of the Nazis, basically control of it was handed over to the CIA. And so from that time forward, the Muslim Brotherhood has been an essential tool of American colonialism in the Middle East. So for example, when they wanted to invade, Afghanistan, they did so, this was admitted by Brzezinski, that they did so by funding the Muslim Brotherhood, which gave the knowing that it would give the Russians no choice but to invade. And then they continued to do so using bin Laden as a bagman to deliver the funds that were collected through the Iran-Contra operation through the sale of cocaine through Nicaragua and their networks with the Mossad. This is an operation, of course, that was incepted by Michael Dean, who was the leader, Zionist leader of the neoconservatives, and in close collaboration with the Saudi royal family, particularly two characters, which was Khalid bin Mahfouz, who was the leader of the Saudi Commercial Bank, I think is what the name is, and Salim bin Laden, who was bin Laden's older brother, working closely with George W. Bush in Texas at the time. And, of course, all those funds were being funneled through MENA, Arkansas, under Bill Clinton's supervision. So that basically, just to give you a very basic idea of, in fact, there's a whole strategy that was developed during the 50s by the CIA, American government, called the religious factor, where they identified the Muslim Brotherhood as the necessary tool for, effectively, the fight against communism, as they called it in the Middle East. So when the Israel needed a boogeyman that they could use as a cover for their colonial actions, they created Hamas, through led founded by a former member of the Muslim Brotherhood. And so this is how.
It's useful to clarify the position before Hamas was with Yasser Arafat and the PLO. This was actually not a specifically Islamic organization. It was effectively a secular organization, and they did that deliberately because they knew there were so many factions, not just within Islam, but also Christian factions in the region, that to have it, you know, at one specific one would just exclude, you know, large parts of the population that they needed to keep on side. So how did we get from Yasser Arafat? Yes, I know the Mossad poisoned him with polonium in his toothpaste and killed him off. That was the gift.
But they also trained him.
Yeah, so then they disposed of him.
Arafat was trained by Otto Skorzeny, Mossad agent.
And they disposed of him, rather like Alexei Navalny has now been disposed of.
Yeah.
But anyway, the point being that how did it come for Hamas to then sort of take over from that? Because it never really did seem to make sense to a lot of Palestinians to have a purely Islamic group running it.
That's history. I don't know, because I don't know Palestinian history well enough for this Palestinian population and mentality well enough to understand how that happened. But it's obviously enough money, and they could pretty much do anything, and all that money came from Israel because that's what they wanted. They basically wanted a tool to offset the influence of the PLO.
So to what extent do you think Hamas is representing the interests of Gaza, or is it just a tool of the Mossad?
It's a tool of that's the problem. It's not. This is the problem worldwide, is that there is no Islamic voice left, and that where, you know, it's a vacuum that was created with the fall of the Ottoman Empire, where traditional Islam, any all support for traditional Islam evaporated. And so this is how Saudi Arabia, with Rockefeller oil money, stepped into the vacuum and filled it as much as they could. So worldwide, you find that Muslims tend to be ignorant of the fact that they are, for the most part, practicing a Saudi and Salafi influence interpretation of Islam, which is what makes them so prone to a lot of really errant beliefs and agendas. So,
you could say the same exact thing about Christianity, actually.
Of course, it's the same. It's always been like that.
These Crowleyites would be rubbing their hands. Anyway, look, so just if you want a final word on Hamas and whether you think it's going to be, they are just going to be using the Palestinian people as a tool, or whether they actually will be able to, you know, represent what people actually want on the ground there. They obviously don't have a state, but they must have the right to self-defense. It's absolutely essential.
they can't represent the people because they're not, they're fraud. They are a fraudulent version of Islam. And so, it's impossible for them to, even with their best intentions. The Palestinians need to recognize, you know, how all humanity needs to recognize. This is the point, right? The problem with humanity is that we underestimate the length that some people will go to achieve power. We think that most people are somehow limited at a certain point by some kind of intrinsic morality. And it's really hard for most of us to recognize that some people are immoral. And, that's what keeps the world naive, and it keeps us gullible. And so,
well, yeah, and they're also recruiting other amoral people and promoting them. All the time they're on the lookout for more and more of them. Anyway, I know one of the favorite angles of your research over the years, David, of mine, has been this whole idea of transhumanism. And this is supposed to be this kind of mythos of the human 2.0. You know, we're going to be evolving all the time, and let's now take command of our own evolution and just send ourselves, and maybe we'll you know, be like Cagliostro. We will be able to make ourselves live forever, and if you pay, you know, Dr. X $40 billion, he can let you have a child that lives forever, you know, this kind of thing. So we've just had the first person, apparently, if you believe it, have the internet plugged into their brain with one of Elon Musk's little devices, haven't we, this month?
Right. So it's funny. This brings back to the point you wanted to touch on before, which is pantheism, because that's what it comes down to. It's a Kabbalistic idea, the Nietzschean idea, that in fact, the whole point of Kabbalah, especially going back to Isaac Luria, which is really at the source of everything that we're talking about, is the idea that the history of humanity is the history of God coming to know himself and through man. And so the end point of this history is that when man recognizes that he is God. And that's what humanism is, and that's what theosophy is, and Nazism is, and the entire plot that we've been discussing.
Yeah, but it's not going to work out for them, is it? I mean, there is going to be a massive clash between these people and the traditionally, you know, moral traditionalists. I mean, in a way, represented by the Orthodox Russians.
Well, God wins in the end. There's no doubt about that.
David, just remind us of your website then, please. You know, the Order Ab KO one, because that's where you can read the book online or get copies.
Thank you. Yes, so my website is ordoabkao.ca. And exactly like you said, I've got links to my previous books, but also my recent book, 6 volumes, is all available to be read directly online.
And we didn't even mention my old school friend, Nick Land. Could you just finish off with just a word about how significant you think he is? Because he's a very difficult person to listen to, but he's extremely, it's becoming more and more revealed to me how influential he's become. You know, what is his role, do you think?
That's a very good question, he just ties in so many people. And as we talked about before, he's considered really one of the leading figures in the accelerationist movement. And accelerationism is all about accelerating the coming of the end times, which is what this is all about. And this is how he links to groups like the Order of Nine Angles, which is a satanic Nazi, occult Nazi organization, which also has links to Dugin. And this is why there's been a growing agitation or activity amongst neo-Nazi terrorist organizations recently. They're all linked to this accelerationist group. Most of them regard Dugin as their leader. So you can basically, I have no idea how he's connected, but it shows how at some level, because again, he influenced Curtis Yarvin and his Dark Enlightenment philosophy, which is the philosophy appropriated by what's his name? Founder of PayPal, Peter Thiel.
Oh, Peter Thiel, yeah, the blood drinker.
Who was a blood drinker, who was also a regular Bilderberger. He was at the most recent Bilderberg conference as well, too. Also founder of PayPal with Elon Musk.
Right? It's a small world. It's a small world. Well, but anyway, like you say, God does win out in all of this. And in a way, by working out, you know, attempting to push their idea on the world through these various tricks, that they are gods. They really, what they're going to do, it seems to me, is to reveal God and his love to many, many more people than they've ever been done before, and actually undo much of the hard work that they put in to killing God off, you know, like Nietzsche wanted. Anyway, David Livingstone, thank you very much again for joining us.
Thank you again, Tony. Always a pleasure.